I'm Laura Harper Lake.
And I'm Sarah Reitzman, and you're listening to Creative Guts.
Hey, listeners, and welcome back to the Creative Guts podcast. Today, we're talking about art more broadly, why art is important to our communities and to our economy, and how we can ensure our communities embrace and support public art, which is very important. And you'll be hearing from Nancy Pearson, a Portsmouth City Councilor who ran on an arts campaign. Nancy is going to talk about the art scene in Portsmouth, how local government can help facilitate public art, and the impact art has on the economy.
Creative Guts, of course, the podcast, is born in the great state of New Hampshire, where Laura and I both live. And
it's awesome to see people that are continuously trying to make it better. We hope you enjoy this episode.
So Nancy Pearson is a Portsmouth City Councilor who ran on an arts campaign, which is so Portsmouth and only Portsmouth.
You're my hero. That's awesome.
Right?
Yeah, it's pretty epic.
So tell us that story and how on earth that came to be.
Well, I was, at the time, I was on the board of ArtSpeak, Portsmouth's cultural commission, and that was part city commission, part nonprofit, related to the city, got some funding from the city and has very specific things it needs to do for the city, like manage its public art program. And so I got to know the policies and the city and what was going on pretty quickly. It was like a crash course in city government in Portsmouth. And fun fact, I'd only lived in Portsmouth like 8 months before I got on this. Of course, I'd lived in Dover and I'd done theater and all kinds of volunteer work in different arts organizations since like 2002 or something. But in 2011, I moved to Portsmouth. And that's when I realized that, yes, Portsmouth considers itself an arts and cultural community. And it was really the arts community that gave Portsmouth its rebirth after the shipyard kind of closed and the Air Force Base closed, and all of a sudden people were jettisoning out of Portsmouth and families, and there was this, well, what is Portsmouth now if it's not a military town? Mm-hmm. Back in the day, back in the 80s, a bunch of creatives, artists, Portsmouth people, many of whom had actually gone through the theater program, the art program at UNH, and had graduated and sort of landed in Portsmouth. And now, what do I do with this theater degree? What do I do with this music degree? What do I do with all this, training that I have? And they, combined with some city leaders, started to do little things like renovate the music hall or start up Theater by the Sea, which is now Seacoast Rep, or start the Prescott Park Arts Festival, which was literally like a red and white striped tent in the middle of Prescott Park. Like, all of that started to bloom back in the 80s. And Portsmouth, little by little, then all of a sudden somebody opened this beautiful restaurant called the Blue Strawberry. And all of a sudden, interesting fine dining started to happen in Portsmouth, which all of this was sort of new. And that's when things became a little bit of a different trajectory for the city. And it was a good trajectory because there really wasn't anything like it in the area. You know, you've got Boston, and then you've got Portland, and there's really not much mm-hmm. going on in between. And so slowly but surely, Portsmouth just solidified this identity. There's no sports team in Portsmouth. You know, there's no ski mountain. Like, what are you going to do when you come to Portsmouth? So now we know you come for the art scene, the great restaurants, and then the backdrop, of course, is this just gorgeous architectural postcard little city. So all of that was going on. That was the identity. And up close and personal, though, from the inside of the Cultural Commission, I thought that the city spoke a lot about its support for arts and culture, but I didn't really see it happening in plain day, especially out in the community, the people doing the artwork. So I wanted to have a stronger voice at City Hall. I wanted people to listen to me. And I figure if I ran for city council and won, people in the city and the city council would have to listen to me. So that's what happened. So my arts platform was essentially, if you think about every single, you know, issue, I have air quotes in the air right now, every single issue that was facing Portsmouth the year that I ran, 2015, they were still around today. Affordable housing, parking, you know, traffic and congestion, general affordability in general. All of that touches the arts in one way or another, because yes. Where are the artists living? Where are the people parking when they come? Like, who's buying the artwork? Who's supporting the arts? Who are the patrons? Who are the artists? How many artists can even still live in this city? So it all kind of connected, and I connected the dots as I was talking about my vision for Portsmouth. You know, it's a community that really identified with that, and so I got elected.
And did they start listening to you?
Yes. So it was good because we had a really powerful and strong voice on the city council already in Chris Dwyer. But she was only one person, you know, and she is very convincing. But if you don't have five people all together voting your policies with you, then, you know, you just really can't get too much done. And so, for example, there was this ordinance that they passed back in 2006 called the Percent for Art Ordinance, which meant that any municipal project, building, renovation that triggered a $2 million budget would have 1% of that budget would go toward a piece of public art. We couldn't get it off the ground because ultimately city council was the one to approve it or approve the budget or cut the budget or whatever they wanted to do. The first couple of attempts that we tried to have this ordinance, this is before my time, somebody cut it from the budget, you know, a city councilor who just really wasn't comfortable with spending taxpayer money on art. We've come such a long way. So that's just one example of how she needed reinforcement, you know. So then there was two of us on the council, and we worked really hard to educate the public. And man, it's like night and day, I think, now.
And the Percent for Art thing is going differently now, isn't it?
So after a couple of failed attempts to get a good project off the ground or any project off the ground, we had a really high profile, big budget project in the new Foundry Place parking garage. This was a $150,000 budget because that's the cap that the city set, because, like, I think the parking garage was $18 million or something. So it would have been even higher, but they had capped it in the ordinance. So we had the potential for $150,000 worth of artwork. And history tells us that the other projects that got whittled away, that budget, till it was almost nothing. And so I just, you know, I just went in there, and I'm sure I told you this story when you were at Leadership Seacoast. I literally elbowed my way to the table of the first committee meeting of the garage. And I was just like, this will not get whittled away. We're keeping it in the budget. You know, it is a line item that will stay over my dead body. Will, you know, this get cut? And so we started at the table, yes. And then, you know, that just reverberated. And by the time it got to city council, it was just never an option or in question. You know, it was always part of the whole project.
So you did a filibuster. Yeah. Like Mr. Smith goes to Washington, didn't eat or drink anything or sit down.
Yeah. I mean, I'm small, but I'm mighty.
I love a nice political win for arts.
Yeah, it doesn't happen a lot, right? So that's right? Wonderful.
I do want to circle back to the affordable housing thing eventually, but first let's back
self-serving
up.
Sarah.
It'd be weird if I went a whole episode without talking about affordable housing.
Yeah, no kidding.
Let's circle back to those terms, arts and culture, which are really broad and sort of subjective. What does that mean to you?
To me, it means my childhood. It means the way I've always seen the world. It's the way that I approach absolutely everything. And when I was a Montessori teacher, I taught first, second, and third grade. I taught every subject matter, including science and math, through the arts. And I feel that that's the thing that humans bring to the table. Math is replicated in nature and science, you know, the patterns, the Fibonacci sequence, all of that, which actually can also pull in, you know, people can use those patterns in art. But the creativity of a novel, the creativity of a work of music, a painting, all of that is uniquely human, and it's the way humans interpret the world around them. So that's the way I've always seen the world. My eyes see the world that way. And arts and culture to me mean a uniquely human way of expressing what you see, how you feel, and how you interpret the things that happen to you on a daily basis, good or bad.
That's lovely. I love hearing that. Do you pursue any kind of artistic field yourself?
Not anymore. I always was doing some sort of visual art and theater since I can remember, especially visual art, just always needing to be touching something, creating something. My mom was a nursery school teacher, so I always had, there was always a box of stuff in our house with every kind of supply that there was when I was a little girl, which is nothing like today.
Yeah.
Oh my God, it's head explosion time. But so I would turn jewelry boxes into dioramas, and that was just after school. I couldn't wait to just decompress and do stuff. And then I have an interest, but probably a stronger talent in the theater arts. So I pursued theater arts, went to school. I went to Emerson, ran out of money, so then I went to state school. I decided to not major in theater, but to minor in it and to do it. I was an English major, which was just as useless, basically. But anyway.
Just as creative.
But just as creative.
Yes.
So I graduated and I started auditioning and did some really fun things my first couple summers out of college. It turns out that theater people and the theater scene professionally is not that is not where I thrive. Mm-hmm. I'm not competitive in that way. I'm competitive in other ways, but not in, I'd be holding the door open for all the other people going into the audition.
Yep.
Be like, la, da, 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 just not, I just didn't have that mindset. And I wanted to leave the drama on the stage. And that's just not the way with a lot of theater people. So I turned all my creative energy into, again, education. I decided to become a Montessori teacher. My entire classroom, it's funny, I taught at the Cornerstone School, and there was two elementary school classrooms for first, second, and third grade, first year, second year, third year. Mine was considered the right brain classroom. So I got all the kids who were sent up from primary to be in the creative classroom. It was really funny. So yeah, we learned photosynthesis doing theater. We learned multiplications by, pattern making and other. I mean, we did everything through the arts. And I enjoyed that so much. And I would run summer arts camps. So I was doing art, but not for my own self. Mm-hmm. I never sold a piece of art or anything like that. But my career just kind of took a different trajectory. I left the classroom and I kind of left running those kind of programs, especially for children, completely altogether. But I've always stayed in the arts. I worked in the theater and dance department at UNH. I worked at the Ogunquit Museum of American Art. I've always been in the realm just facilitating the creativity of other people. And that's kind of how I ended up on the commission, on Art Speaks Cultural Commission. Just, well, why not facilitate a whole city's cultural creativity? So I don't get to do it anymore, which is why I'm in this building today. And I'm so happy because I miss it. I do.
In the theater that you performed, just going back to that, I'm always fascinated and very jealous about people who can perform. Was it musicals or was it plays?
Oh, Lord, not a musical.
No, I
wish. I definitely fall into the comedic sidekick. You guys are too young, but I grew up on Mary Tyler Moore and Carol Burnett.
Yeah.
And Rhoda was always that is my soulmate right there. Miss Rhoda, the creative, wisecracking sidekick. That's my wheelhouse. And it's really funny. I did that, those kind of roles, those great character comedic roles all through high school and college. And then when I started doing Portsmouth theater, I got cast as leading ladies, like romantic leading ladies. Oh. And I was like, what do I do here?
This
like,
took a turn.
What? It was really strange. Then I got just a little too old for that. And now they're casting, you know, every once in a while, a friend will tap me and say, hey, I want you to do this like teeny tiny little perfect character role that will take you 45 minutes of rehearsal time. And I'm like, yes, I will do that, you know, in and out, you know, so.
That's cool. Awesome. So let's talk a little bit about the value of arts and culture and those amenities for Portsmouth as a community, for Portsmouth residents, for the economy, of course, because you did that economic impact study of the arts for Portsmouth's economy.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I have this conversation all over the state. I sit on the steering committee of the Creative Communities Exchange. I have advised other communities in New Hampshire who want to know about writing a cultural plan. And not every town or city needs or should be a cultural city. Like, some have other identities. For Portsmouth, it is so entrenched in the identity. I think it's because it's been decades, you know, since the 80s. But even before that, Portsmouth has always had just sort of this, its own independent flair, you know, which is the ultimate creative endeavor, just to do what you want whenever you want. That's kind of Portsmouth. But I think that one of the ways that it's sort of infused itself into the everyday just landscape of Portsmouth is that whenever we talk about anything, like if we do a design charrette or if we're talking about redoing, you know, a streetscape, the community input sessions, they'll say public art. They'll say, you know, where is there going to be a venue, or, you know, they'll want to rebrand a whole area, like down in the West End part of Portsmouth has been branded like the Arts District, or just because so many people ended up there after they either couldn't find space or couldn't afford space in the downtown core anymore. And now that's just its own like awesome personality. I think one of the, and you'll appreciate this, Sarah, I think one of the ways you know that your community sort of eats and breathes the culture around it is when it starts showing up in a master plan.
Yeah.
Before, we had a master plan in Portsmouth and we had a cultural plan. The cultural plan in Portsmouth is like 15 years old. And at one point, I thought it needed to be updated and refreshed and we needed to go back and talk to the community about its needs. But then I started to look at our 2020 master plan that had tons of public input and Portsmouth listens and all kinds of community participation. And the entire plan is infused with arts and culture from beginning to end, top to bottom. And I was like, I don't even know if we need a cultural plan anymore. It's actually infused into the physical plan and goals of our city. Like, cha-ching.
That's like, awesome.
How much more could you ask for, right?
That's a good way to like measure success too.
So for this last example that I mentioned at the garage, we anticipated some pushback on that, especially because we were fully funding it, $150,000. We did some community education around it. We brought the community in. We connected an archaeological study of the area that the garage was going in and connected it to, you know, the history of Portsmouth, what was there before, what does it mean for the values of our city, how do we connect that to the future, where we're headed. And when we opened up that kind of conversation with the people that came to our public input sessions, and they understood that here we had an opportunity to speak to that, and the art proposals that we got in really did, because that's what we requested in our request for proposals. Like, these are the things we want you to speak about. The ultimate works are so, like, they could only live right there.
Yeah.
They wouldn't make sense two blocks in either direction.
Wow.
Like, they were so site-specific, and they so honored what was there. You couldn't ask for anything more. And there was literally zero, like zero, I got no email that said, I can't believe we've spent this much money. And I got no email that said, this is inappropriate.
None?
It wasn't. Zero.
That's not crazy.
One. No letters to the editor.
Wow.
It was.
Well, you did it right then, you know, putting in respect to what was there and, you know, having it, the space evolves, but in a way that makes sense.
Right.
That's one of the benefits of public art that I hadn't put a lot of thought into until right this second, which is the teachings about history. Like, I know more about Portsmouth's history from the public art than I do about, say, Durham's history, where I live. I don't know anything about the history of Durham, and there's no public art that really, like, speaks to that.
Mm-hmm. I was listening to a presentation at a planning conference because I like to go to those things.
Nerd.
I know. And it was about the African burying ground. And one of the panelists was talking about how public art is there when you need it. Even if it's the middle of the night, it'll be there for you. And something like the burying ground, some people need that, and they might need that. They might need to sit in that space in the middle of the night, you know, depending on what's happening in the world during their day. Whatever.
Very poetic.
And I just, that always stayed with me. Like, yeah, it's always there for you.
That's a beautiful thought.
Yeah.
I've never thought of it that way.
I love public art.
Me too.
What's your favorite sort of piece of public art in Portsmouth? I know that's really hard. Though you might say Foundry just because it's the most, like, you know, but like I think about the Whale Wall, which I like have loved since I was a little kid.
That is very difficult. I'm so emotionally and professionally wrapped up in the, especially the Hammers sculpture that Terrence Parker just made for Foundry Place. And if you could have been in the room the day, so we brought in six finalists. We had 13 submissions for the whole entry. Mm-hmm. And we brought in six finalists to interview because we wanted to make sure, you know, they could build and create the thing that they proposed, and we had questions. Terrence Parker walked in. It was a snowstorm morning. He lives somewhere in Maine. He had shoveled out like a 200-foot-long driveway to get to Portsmouth City Hall. Like, schools were closed. Like, it was that kind of morning. It's an 8 a.m. meeting or something. So he was probably up like at the crack of whatever. And he comes in and he has props. He has hammers. He has anvils. He has all these things. He has PowerPoint presentation, and he walked us through his entire thought process and the creative process for his submission. And he left the room, and we were all like, he swept us off our feet. Oh. His story behind the art was so meaningful. So I think that work is my favorite because I got to see the whole thing happen before my eyes.
And that's in the middle of the circle in front of the Foundry Garage, right?
Yeah.
That's beautiful.
And then when we did the opening, he invited the leftist marching band, of course, because you can't really do anything of significance in Portsmouth without the leftist marching band, the street, you know, the street band doing their like New Orleans style street band. And then he read a poem. Oh, but wait, there's more. So it's not just the leftist marching band playing like they typically do if they're in front of the South Church or whatever. They take their percussive instruments, their, you know, what are these?
Mallets?
Drumsticks and other things. And they play the sculpture. The sculpture becomes the instrument. And so they're playing, and the horns are playing, but like all the percussive people in the band are playing metal hammers and, you know, other parts of the, and they all sound a little different. They're all forged differently. They're different sizes, so they have different sounds. And Terrence climbs up on top of his sculpture and reads a poem.
Aww.
And they're behind him playing. And I'm just like, what is happening right now? Like the whole thing. Then we all walked over to Liar's Bench Beer Company, where they had created a special beer named after Terrence's piece, working with the label that was the sketch from his.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, it was just so full circle, so Portsmouth. It was amazing.
I love that.
So I don't know how that can't be my favorite.
Right.
Because the whole thing.
That's a great story.
That is just so organic.
Great story.
And so community. Everybody was there. And yeah.
I've already heard this story, but I really want to hear it again because it was hysterical. Will you tell us about the glass etching person?
Seth Palmiter? What part was hysterical?
The part where he had to stay at your house for 3 weeks.
Right. So, yeah. So he is a very prolific public artist. He does work all over the country, California, like everywhere. He even has other works in New Hampshire and also lives in Maine. So he's coming down, I think it's like 2.5 hours, 3 hours away. So I'm like, oh, you're going to need a place to stay. So I reached out to some of the hotel people in the area and said, can you put up one of our artists? That would be amazing. And because it's right across the street from Portwalk, right? So they're like, yeah, yeah. And I get him like a few nights, right? And that's it's around the holidays. It's not a real busy time and it's the shoulder season-ish. But I'm very grateful. Like, okay, I got you a couple of nights at the – it's right across the street. You're going to be all set up. He's like, great, perfect. So how long is this going to take you? And he's like, yeah, about 3 weeks. And I'm like also, it was like – 0 degrees and windy, which made it last so much longer. It probably could have been done in a week. But anyway, so I was like, oh, I cannot get you a hotel room in downtown Portsmouth, like complimentary for 3 weeks. Like, that's not going to happen. So, yeah. So he stayed with us.
Oh.
And he's a sweetheart. And he was, you know, he was very earnest, very a good house guest. But at the end of his stay, of course, we're like BFFs now. We were putting in a new bathroom in the house and we were putting in shower glass walls. And he's like, oh, I can etch those for you as a thank you.
Oh,
so he hasn't done it yet. I haven't like pulled the trigger, but I was like, if I want custom artwork in my bathroom,
that is so
he
awesome.
Will come and etch my walls for me.
Isn't that a great story?
The value of your property just goes
right
up.
Seth Palmer right? original, yeah. right? And it's attached to the wall, so like it would have to stay. I don't know. I'd probably figure out a way to take it with you,
yeah.
If I could.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was great. So I got to know him really well as well. And both of them were just, it was, yeah, that whole project was just super fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. And so Portsmouth's little arts and culture scene is also a boon for the economy, right? There's an economic impact there.
It is indeed. So in my time at ArtSpeak, the city has undergone 3 economic impact studies through Americans for the Arts. They do them every 5 years. We have wonderful qualitative stories about the impact of arts and culture and what they mean, but we have not a lot of quantitative data to show. And Americans for the Arts really helps with those people that need quantitative data mm-hmm. that says that arts is good for a community. So that's the data that Americans for the Arts provides. So it tells you how much money people are spending when they come into your town or city to experience a cultural event. And what do they, you know, pay for parking? What do they pay for food? What do they pay maybe a hotel? And all of that information goes back to these this army of accountants in D.C. at Americans for the Arts. And they actually calculate municipal and state taxes and everything. They give you the grand total. They break it down by resident and non-resident. This is how I know that Portsmouth's residents, it's like 2 to 1 are the ones coming to the cultural events in Portsmouth. I mean, we do have a lot of visitors, but Portsmouth residents are the majority consumers of arts events in Portsmouth. So that's who's supporting.
Probably why they moved there too.
Yeah. 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 So I think the first time Portsmouth did it, the impact was something like $35 million, and we were all very surprised. I wasn't there at the time, but I knew this number. My first year on ArtSpeak, I came in halfway through the second study, so I kind of took that torch and ran with it. And the second study, the number went up to something like $43.5 or something like that, $1 million impact annually. This is every year. And then the last time we did it in 2016, it's $53 million. So it goes up
amazing
every year.
Well, you're always offering more and more every year.
Well,
you know, new venues and new places.
It's important to know, though, and every time we talk about these numbers are all the other people that are benefiting from the arts and cultural venues. This isn't the money that's going to the cultural venues.
Right. Yep.
So a lot of times people hear those numbers and think, well, maybe, you know, that's great. You know, our theaters are healthy, or, you know, whatever, galleries are healthy.
No, it's like the eating and the parking.
Right. Yep. Yeah, yep. It's mostly hotels and restaurants.
Yeah, yeah. I know those of us, there are some people who are very fuzzy and, you know, warm and fuzzy in their hearts. And they're a little, I don't want to say, a little bitter about, like, using that, like, the economy or, like, keep arts in schools because it improves math performance. It's like, no, keep art in schools because, like, it's really important on its own, independent of its impact on math. Mm-hmm. And so part of that, like, I'm like, arts and culture is really important for your community. Yes, it's also important for your economy. But, like, the really, like, warm and fuzzy part of me is like, who cares about the economy? Like, let's talk about it as it's really important.
But whatever can get people in the door to be more accepting mm-hmm. is what you have to chase because, yep. you know, just like people are different learners, like you're a visual learner or you have to do it or you have to, you know, people will digest and accept information in different ways.
Yeah.
So that's very important to do.
The the economic argument is also incredibly powerful for, like, decision makers making policy. Mm-hmm. And I come up against the same thing with workforce housing. Like, workforce housing is really important for the economy. It's also really important because you need somewhere to live, but, like, who cares about that? It's really important for the economy. And that's what, like, the decision makers grab onto in here. These, like, politicians are like, yes, the economy. Mm-hmm. So
unfortunately, you're absolutely right. And it was the economic impact of arts and culture that actually got the state of New Hampshire, the Arts Council, to begin with back in the 60s. Like, you convinced, I mean, back then it was an all-male state legislature, mostly Republican, you know, back in the 60s, although New Hampshire Republicans were really very moderate. But even then, the only way they would be convinced to have a state arts council tied to the NEA was because somebody gave them data on economics.
Yeah.
So that's just, you're absolutely right. But I'm not one of those people. I mean, I think it's great. And I talk to a lot of business leaders and I'm a policymaker and I rely on the data, but that's not where my heart is.
Yeah. Yep. I can relate to that.
In that economic study, I'm wondering, is any of the data being collected of folks who, you know, they're spending money on parking and restaurants? What about other stores that they're buying, you know, retail at along the way to the theater?
There is. Yeah, I think there's a line item for, I think they just call it souvenirs.
Okay.
So anything else that you would have purchased.
Yeah, because when I go to Portsmouth, yeah. and I, like, every once in a while we do a shop day, you know, or more rather, like, oh, I want to see the opening at the Nakata. And then I happen to go by Bull Moose, and then I happen to go by, you know, the next place, and I end up spending a little bit more than I expected. But one place drew me in.
Yep.
And more caught me.
Yep. Bull Moose is the best.
Yeah,
I can't walk by there without going in. It kind of makes me sad that CDs are sort of like on the way out because I love going to Bull Moose to get a CD.
Yeah.
Well, gee, you know, you can keep them. You can keep them in business by buying them.
Buy some CDs.
They have vinyl, too. I mean, I get vinyl there of, like, newer bands. Yeah. So that's kind of nice.
So I promised I'd go back to the affordable housing comment.
Bet our listeners are super excited right now.
Thank goodness she didn't forget. I wanted to know where she
Cheers
was going
are
with that.
Ringing across the internet. Yay!
So there was a comment made on Leadership Seacoast Day, and it was very easy for me to be an arts and culture day where I'm surrounded by arts and culture people and make those ties back to housing and housing affordability. But there was a comment made about how the artists of the 70s who made Portsmouth what it was or what it is now can't afford to live there anymore. And he said it very sort of cavalier and very like, that's just how it goes. You know, artists pick depressed places that are more affordable and then they invest in them through the art and then they're a wonderful, vibrant place and then they get priced out. And to me, that feels icky, like a big injustice. And I talked to Catherine Stewart about it and we'll talk to her about it when we get to her interview. But we were talking about how one, that's so unfair. But two, it also really reflects that, like, artists aren't being paid more despite the fact that they're contributing this incredible thing to the economy. So let's just talk about that.
Yeah, that's a lot to unpack there. And actually, you know, it's true-ish. I mean, if you were lucky enough to be an artist in the 70s and 80s, your house was probably like $70,000. And if you're still living in it, amazing.
Yeah.
Don't move, right?
Don't ever move.
Don't ever move. Although their house now is worth $700,000 probably. But I think that your point about artists not being paid enough is an essential point, but also who's buying art, right?
Right. Who is buying art?
Who's buying art and what are we willing to spend on it? Mm-hmm. I just renovated my house. I don't have that many walls. All of my walls are filled with art, local art.
Yeah.
I have no more walls. Mm-hmm. I saw gorgeous paintings in the studio over there. I have no walls to put more paintings on. Like, I'm done. I'm like, so I can go to performing arts things. I can buy jewelry like I did today.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like you need a bigger house.
But like... But like, yeah, who's buying the art? What are they willing to spend? And it's interesting. I have a client, and one of the women that I provide business services to, and for years she's been an art dealer on up and coming artists, mm-hmm. sort of like right at the tier before they become supernova, unaffordable. That's her sweet spot. Her client list has been dropping like flies. Ever since the Great Recession, that level of art buyer has disappeared and not come back. She's trying to figure out, like, a couple of tiers down, that sort of artist, and how, and then she has to build a whole new clientele that's completely new and foreign to her if she wants to stay in this business. So, like, yeah, this is visual art. Who's buying art? And who's willing to pay the price for what it costs? We know that for performing arts, you can't charge a ticket price for what it costs to put on the arts, which is why arts venues are always raising money.
Yeah.
Because it costs, what, $300 a ticket to put on a show? Nobody's going to pay that in Portsmouth. It's really tricky.
That is tricky. That's really tricky.
It's tough.
And I was talking about artists live workspace or you know, artist housing maybe a year, 2 years ago. And people came out of the woodworks. Why are they a special group? Why would artists get affordable housing over just anybody?
Oh, interesting. Know?
There's so much value in buying local art. And maybe part of our job is to, as you know, Creative Guts, the podcast, is to ensure that people understand how important that is and then go do it. There was a young woman at Leadership Seacoast, one of the board members, who was talking about how that's something that she prioritizes. And so she spends money on art from local artists. You get to make decisions every time you spend a dollar. And if you're spending a dollar on local art instead of, you know, don't buy your art at Walmart.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Home Goods.
Let's not even, mm-hmm. we can't go there today. Our house is filled with art from every place that we travel. My husband and I are big travelers. So I have art from Austin and New Orleans and Portland and Pasadena, California and Iceland. And it's like when we travel, we make it a priority because that connects it to the culture of the city we went to.
Art is my favorite souvenir. You know, it's not like buying a t-shirt. So local art is, but it's local when I bought it because I was there.
Yeah.
And so I don't know. I count it as local art and put it in like the good category.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Because there are folks from Austin coming here and buying a Portsmouth or Exeter or wherever based artist. And, you know, it's making a difference here and it's living somewhere else. I have some of my work is in England. Some folks from England have bought sculptures of mine in the past. Like, it's a nice feeling to know that those little children of mine are somewhere out in the world doing their thing.
Your babies.
Yeah.
I want to talk about the little vacant space in the Foundry garage where you hung, you hung like photos from local photographers.
So that was an accidental, serendipitous exhibition. The windows were going to be looking into an unfinished space and they didn't want that to happen. So one of the gentlemen who works in the parking department reached out to Mary Jo Brown from Brown & Company. Do you know Mary Jo?
Yeah.
And asked if she would curate a photography exhibition that equaled the number of the window panels. And so I was on Facebook one night, which I do too much of at night, sitting on Facebook multitasking. And I see a Brown & Company thing come across my feed, a call to artists for Foundry Place. Artists sent in these beautiful photographs and artwork, photographs of artwork from all over the city. And they're in the windows there. And they connect the etched glass man all the way, you know, the length of the garage to the working sculpture of the hammers. And the committee that was doing public art had no idea this was going on. It just happened. And it was actually done before either of the actual pieces for the percent for art, and it all just blends together. Now, people keep asking me if that's permanent, and it as soon as there's a retail store in there or a entity or an organization or whatever, you know, those will probably be coming down. Maybe they'll go inside. I don't know. Yeah. It remains to be seen what will happen to them. But that was like the best art accident that ever happened. I don't
very cool.
It's not really an accident because they were very intentional about it. It's just that we didn't know. And it was just awesome.
It's very cool.
And perhaps what's living there will influence what's to come. Maybe someone will see the potential of that and be like, oh, let's tie this in somehow.
Yeah. I hope so. I know a lot of people respond really positively about it. I hear about it all the time.
It's a trend that I really like, the use of vacant storefront for art. It's something Rochester does a lot.
Yeah, we talked about that.
Project or policy you're most proud of? I already know the answer.
Well, obviously, I think it's the Foundry Place public art. And the fact that the one we just talked about sort of like fell into it, like, is just I think evidence of the fact that it just was just waiting to happen. Like, we were just waiting for a great opportunity to pull in like all this great creative work and celebrate what people are doing in and around the town. So yeah, that was it.
That's awesome.
Very cool.
So with that,
show us your creative guts.
Thank you so much, Nancy. It was so fun to talk to you, and especially me, who is not really involved in the political realm. You know, hearing what Nancy did is very unorthodox, and it was really exciting, and I'm really happy to hear she was so successful.
If you want to learn more about Portsmouth, I highly recommend you just go visit. Park in the Foundry Garage, stroll by the Whale Wall, and head down to Prescott Park.
And as always, Creative Guts is available on all major podcast platforms and even some of the little ones. So go out there and find us. And of course, follow us on Facebook, Creative Guts Podcast. Thanks again for your support, for listening, and go out there and be creative, folks.
That felt easier. Are we getting better at this?
Probably.
Yay! Great job!
Woohoo!
Woohoo! We did it!
Woohoo!